Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in today. And I'm going to turn our attention now to a new book that's out on Frank Lloyd Wright. It's called Building Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's Home of Love and Loss. I think there are few artists who are as well known as Frank Lloyd Wright. His roots in Wisconsin run deep. And whether people like or detest his aesthetic, there's no doubt he was a genius as an architect, for sure, and a larger-than-life character. But there's a different side to Wright that's rarely seen, and a tragedy that couldn't but help but affect him very deeply. Ron McCrae, a prize-winning journalist who worked on the news desks of several major newspapers, also city editor for the Capital Times here in Madison, and for a decade, and he's a strong interest in architecture and wrote this amazing new book. It's called Building Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's Home of Love and Loss. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And Ron, it's a pleasure to have you with us today.
Gosh, and thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. Frank Lloyd Wright had deep ties to the land in southwest Wisconsin, where Taliesin sits, the third one. Talk about that. What were those ties?
Well before Wright built Taliesin, he had already had about 30 years of experience in the valley there in the Spring Green area. His mother's family, the Lloyd Joneses, settled there from Wales, and as a teenager, he spent a lot of time in the valley and writes about this in his autobiography. He didn't like farming very much, but he loved the valley. Even well before he did Taliesin, he started getting commissions. All the commissions he received in the valley were done by women. His aunts commissioned him to do the Hillside School, the first version and the second version. He built a home for his sister, Tanny Derry, which means under the oaks. He built this very experimental windmill called Romeo and Juliet that his uncles all scoffed at and said it would blow down, but it's still there, and they're not. And of course, his mother was a daughter of that family. So he spent and his children went to the Hillside School. He spent a lot of time in the valley. And one of the things I have in my book, which is I think new to a lot of people, is that he took a portfolio of photographs, of landscape photographs of the valley in 1900, probably using glass plates in the winter. And they're just wonderful winter scenes.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
You can see that he really had memorized the valley by the time he started thinking about making a home there.
Yeah, you really can. And I should go back and just ask you, in terms of the book itself is amazing. You can tell the journalist in you because you were able to tie some things together that really I don't think it had been tied together before.
There's a lot that's news in this book, and yeah. That really pleases me. I had some real breaks. I'd been preparing myself. I've been reading and writing about Wright for maybe 30 years, on and off. At the same time, I was working as an editor, and my main job was to help other reporters look better in print and give them good headlines. Now I had a chance to do something of my own. But I had a real break when I happened to see a website advertising some photographs of Taliesin 1 under construction. And this was from the Utah State Historical Society. And I thought, there are no such photos. There were never any pictures of it taken in 1911. But and the journalist in me made me ask more questions. And I had a friend go over and take a personal look. And he said, yeah, these are construction sites. Wow. So I ordered the photos and was just amazed at what I saw. They didn't quite understand what they had. All of the pictures of Taliesin were listed as unidentified building.
Oh.
And and then also because I had written about the album of pictures that had been found on eBay in 2005, I had seen those and I thought, gee, a lot of these look like the pictures in Utah. And so I was able to match up about 20 of them and to conclude that I could now solve the mystery of who the photographer was.
Which was a great story.
Yeah, that was fun. But the core of the – there used to be only about – as really recently as 20 years ago, there were only – maybe 15 pictures of Taliesin and one that were known. They were all taken in August of 1912, 100 years ago this month. And now there are about 90, now that we've found all these things.
Well, it's quite the revelation, and the photography, the photos that you've come up with, and so many of them, as you say, have really never been seen before. It's wonderful collection.
Well, this young man who was the photographer was very energetic. Taylor Woolley was only 26 when he took these pictures. He was from Utah. He was a Mormon, though not very observant, but interested in architecture. And Wright had taken him to Italy in 1910 to work on a two-volume set of books that he was going to be publishing in Germany. And he trusted him enough to invite him back to Taliesin in the fall of 1911 when it was under construction. I think he invited him back because he had gotten to know Mame of Borthwick, and they had become friends, and he could trust him with her. And Wright was still traveling back and forth to Chicago. And Taliesin, by the way, was built in secret. It was all done in stealth. It was done under cover of being a home or a cottage for his mother, and his mother signed the deed, which also prevented his wife from getting hold of the property. And it was not until December of 1911 that it was announced there. But Taylor Woolley came and he brought his camera, and I'm pretty well sure that it's a 1909 Kodak Model 3A. It was called a postcard camera. It took a negative that was 3 1/4 inches by 5 1/2 and could be directly printed without having to be enlarged. So it was very popular. But it also gave a nice big horizontal negative, and that's what they have at Utah is the negatives.
Well, it's wonderful. And you're talking about Mema there. Frank was married, living with his wife and children in Oak Park, Illinois, but then he met Mema Borthwick Cheney.
Mm-hmm.
And who was she?
Well, she was an educated suburbanite. She was in her 40s. They were both in their 40s when all this transpired, and Wright built a house for her and her husband, Edwin Cheney, in around 1906, and not too far from the home and studio, and they fell in love. And they both had large households. I looked at the census from 1910, and she had 9 people in her household, including her mother-in-law, her sister, a Swedish houseman, and an Irish nurse. Three children. And he had 6 children, 4 of whom were still at home, and his wife and his mother living next door. So, but they fell in love, and it was more than simply an erotic relationship. I'll always think it was certainly that. But they also saw that they both had artistic and creative aims. They were both feeling stale in their marriages. It's quite common today. It was treated as something very exotic back then, but it's fairly common. But they had tried to get their spouses to agree to divorces a year before they went to Europe together, and Edwin Cheney did agree, and Catherine Wright would not agree, and she would never agree until well into the 20s, well after Mema was gone. So they took off together to Europe, and then the scandals erupted in Germany when they were found living together or staying together at a hotel in Berlin by a reporter for the Chicago Tribune, and which would not happen today, Larry, because there are no Chicago Tribune reporters anywhere outside the United States. They've all shut down their foreign bureaus. They could get away with it now.
Wow. That time in Europe had quite an influence on them, I believe.
It did. But from the perspective of Taliesin, the most important influence was living on a hillside over Florence, Italy, and getting to understand, getting back in touch really with nature, living in a little garden villa, a walled villa with a little garden in it overlooking the Arno River Valley. I've been there. My wife and I went in 2004. It's just gorgeous. And I think that is where he got the inspiration for Taliesin. He needed a solution. How were they going to resume their lives back in the United States? They couldn't go to Chicago. He wrote his mother on the 4th of July that it would be impossible for them to come back to Oak Park. And in the same letter, he says, "What about that land right next to Uncle Thomas's there in the valley? I think I might like to farm that." And that is really the first identification of Taliesin. And he's thinking about that on the 4th of July on a hillside in Italy. And 1 year later, they're on a hillside in Wisconsin, overlooking another river valley.
Isn't that absolutely amazing? And Mama, I want to go back to her for just a second. She had an interesting relationship with a Swedish writer. Ellen Kay, was it?
Yes, Ellen Kay, K-E-Y, but I think it is pronounced K. And she, Ellen Kay turns out to be a major character in this book for a couple of reasons. She was a Swedish philosopher, writer, activist. She wrote a big book, had a small book that had a big influence on modern furniture and design called Beauty in the Home, which oddly enough was never translated until 2008 into English. But she also wrote books on marriage reform and on progressive education. And Mama was inspired by her because basically she, among other things, wrote that a marriage that is not founded on love is not legitimate and is in fact harmful. And the only marriages that are really truly marriages are those based in love. And of course, Ellen Kay also argued that the law should only deal with the welfare of children and not deal with marriage at all. But so she wanted to bring the message of Ellen Kay to the American readers. And so she did undertake to translate several of her books and write publish them in Chicago. And there was another book published in New York.
And we'll take up that conversation a little bit more, talk about Ellen Kay. And also, obviously, Mama has an interesting story, an interesting part of Frank Lloyd Wright's life. We'll be back after the news. One of Wisconsin's best-known artists is the architect Frank Lloyd Wright. He has deep family roots in our state. He carried the prairie aesthetic that he learned to love here with him around the world. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Taliesin was his home and workplace in Wisconsin, and while many have visited and enjoyed the site, there's a tragic story about it that's not well known. Ron McCrae has written an incredible book about the first Taliesin and the woman that Wright shared it with. It's a fascinating story, and Ron is with us until 12:30 today to tell us about it. Do you enjoy Wright's work? Is the story of his relationship with Mama new to you? Call in with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page, post a question there at The Larry Mueller Show. Stay with us. Back after the news. Few artists are as well known as Frank Lloyd Wright. His roots in Wisconsin are very deep, and he was a genius as an architect, a larger-than-life character. And Ron McCrae has written about him. Ron's a prize-winning journalist who worked on the news desks of several major newspapers, city editor for the Cap-Times here in Madison for a decade. He has a strong interest in architecture and wrote this really amazing book. It's called Building Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's Home of Love and Loss, published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. And you may have an interest in Wright. Maybe you're a fan of Wright. Is the story of his relationship with Mama new to you or interesting to you? Hope you'll join in because the book covers that period in Wright's life. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And Ron, your book really covers the first Taliesin. So we're talking about not really the Wright that so many of us have kind of come to think about.
No. This is one of the things that emerges when you look back to the very beginnings here is that this was a much different person than the one people who were still around who remember the cranky old guy who was always criticizing the local buildings and being arrogant and obnoxious, turning off a lot of people while still doing great work. As one of my friends said, you wouldn't have wanted to live next door to Beethoven either. But the Wright that we meet here before the mass murder and destruction of Taliesin in 1914 is a much more sensitive and sharing guy. And he actually spends a lot of time trying to support the creative work of his companion, Mama Borthwick, in her publishing and goes out to try to deal with publishers with her and travels with her to New York and to Japan. But this is a very small period of time, and this is that really is, only embraces 1910 with the inspiration from Taliesin in Italy to 1914 when it was destroyed by fire and mass murder on August 15th of 1914. So it's a very compressed amount of time, but they really packed a lot into it. He did some of his best work in architecture. He did the Midway Gardens in Chicago, a huge complex. He did Taliesin itself. He did the first plans for the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, and he opened a whole second career as an art dealer in Japanese art, which for a time he actually was bigger at that and made more money at that than his architecture. So he had a second income stream. She, meanwhile, was translating four books and having to cope with the controversy surrounding their lives. So it was a very intense and interesting period, which was kind of the rise and fall that all happened in 4 years. And then it all came to a tragic end.
It certainly did. And I guess outrage at the way they were conducting himself probably cost him some business. I mean, anymore in this day and age, it would hardly raise an eyebrow, I don't think.
Yeah, it might be an advantage. Gives you a little media buzz today. But no, he said at the time that this was going to cost him business, especially because he was mostly a domestic architect. He did private homes. And he said at the time that an architect is very much like a physician. You're sharing your most intimate relations with him or her, and you're having to put your trust in that person. And so he expected that he would lose a lot of business for private homes, and he did. But luckily, he also had some big commercial projects and schoolhouses and this second career as an art dealer.
And Taliesin was to be the first Taliesin was to be their home where they could live their life together, and also a place for Frank to work, if I'm not mistaken. Why don't you describe that setting and the design of the building?
Well, actually, let me let Mema describe it. She writes a letter in the end of 1911 to her friend in Sweden, and this is how she describes what she found when she got to Wisconsin. She says, "I have made a choice in harmony with my own soul and what I believe to be Frank Wright's happiness, and I'm now keeping his house for him. In this very beautiful hillside, as beautiful in its way as the country about Strand." Strand is the name of the home of this woman on a lake in Sweden. "He has been building a summer house, Taliesin, the combination of site and dwelling, quite the most beautiful I have seen any place in the world. We are hoping to have some photographs to send you soon." And these are the photographs in my book, I think.
Mm-hmm.
"Yeah, I believe it is a house founded on Ellen Kay's ideal of love. The nearest neighbor halfway away, a mile away, is Frank's sister." And that's Jane at Tanny Dairy, where she stayed because the house was not finished for her to move in when she came there in August of 1911. "When I visited when I first came here, she has championed our love most loyally, believing it her brother's happiness. I have thus far been very busy with the unfinished house, and because of the fact that workmen were boarded here in a nearby farmhouse, sometimes as many as 36 at a time. Mr. Wright's sister looked after this all summer, but when I came it was turned over to me, and I have done very, very little translation work in consequence of the building. The house is now, however, practically finished and my time again free." And she says that Wright will have his studio there, and they will have no other outside interests. Wright did keep an office in Chicago, so that he did keep a Chicago presence. And he had plans for a lovely-looking townhouse on the near north side. So it might have been that Taliesin was built originally, as she says there, as a summer house.
Yeah.
But the other plans never took fruition, and so it became a house for all seasons.
And, you know, we know that, or at least what we hear, was that he had a huge ego. But his relationship with Mema was quite different. They were really partners.
They were creative partners, and they really did support each other. He was very almost sentimental about her, and he, at the end of, after she died, he wrote a letter, a very heart-wrenching letter to Ellen Kay, saying that, well, he had to make it basically a decision whether he was going to give in to despair as the heart of her would have me put her life, honor her life by putting it into the forms that take place under my hands. Mm-hmm. So it's really saying, I will I will honor her spirit with my architecture, which is not the kind of Frank Lloyd Wright we're used to hearing.
No.
They often say that that Taliesin was his alter ego, and I think with time, both of them grew. His ego and his alter ego.
Oh, man. John in Eagle River, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I was just down in the area just a few weeks back when it was like 100 degrees, and I heard Frank Lloyd Wright, as talented as he was, and I love the details of what he does in his houses. And he was a very mean, guy, a womanizer, and basically...
You know what, John? I'm sorry, but we're breaking up, and I'm really not hearing all of what you're saying. But I think I got the gist of it. I think it sounds like he was just thinking about whether it was true of how mean and so forth. Is it really true that he was a womanizer and that he was mean, sort of mean spirited later in life? Was that really him?
Well. Let's see. First two questions. I think he always needed a woman with him, and he wanted a woman who spoke to his needs at the moment. I don't think he was a womanizer. I think he was a serial monogamist. He was never unmarried. It was not just always to the same woman at the same time. There was some overlap between his first and second wives and his second and third wives, but they did wind up marrying them all. The only one he couldn't marry was Mema because she was murdered. He would have, I think, had Catherine allowed him to have a divorce, and this controversy would not have taken place. And was he nasty? I think he wanted to be provocative, and it was a part of his media charm, in a way. But and he was fighting real fights. There were a lot of banks and others who just did not want to finance something different or original. Still true today, and so he did have some actual fights. And he also, however, if you read his work, he has a tremendous sense of humor and a tremendous sense of wordplay. And so he always seemed to have, and he loved movies and he loved Westerns. And so I think there was a charming side to him, but his public side grew more irascible as the years went on. And that's the right we tend to remember. That he told the Madison City Council when he was trying to sell Monona Terrace, he said, "You're probably just a bug of, you're too smug and provincial to try something great." You know, and that was his sales pitch.
Yeah. And that's why it took, 70 years or whatever it was to get the...
Well, that and the other thing that he did that was even more controversial in a way was that he was a pacifist, and he was a pacifist in World War II. And several of his apprentices went to federal prison rather than serve in World War II. Others offered the alternative of prison to going into the army, took the army.
Our guest today, Ron McCrae, his book, Building Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's Home of Love and Loss. Great to have him along. You have questions about Wright or about Taliesin, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. And I think we really haven't talked about this. I mean, that 1914, they'd settled into a comfortable life at Taliesin, and Mema's children were visiting for the summer, and then tragedy struck.
Yes, to give you a little idea of how they'd weathered the controversy, Mema writes a letter to Ellen Kay, saying, "You'll be interested, I think, to know how our attempt to do what we believed right has succeeded. I can now say that we have, I believe, the entire respect of the community in which we live. I have never encountered a glance otherwise, and many kind and thoughtful things have been done for us by the people around here." And they were looking forward to going to Japan. She was inviting her mentor from Sweden to come and stay with them in Japan. And then all of a sudden, on a summer's day in 1914, when her children are visiting, which they did every year, a man named Julian Carlton, who was a chef and servant who was there with his wife Gertrude, had just come that summer and had come highly recommended from Chicago, basically snapped and had a paranoid break and set the place on fire and attacked seven people with a shingling hatchet as they were seated for lunch at opposite ends of the house, and killed Mamah Borthwick and her two children and four others in the space of about an hour. I mean, it was, when you look at it, it really had a kind of Rambo quality. It had a lot of premeditation. He waited until the noon hour when everyone was seated and separated. So he had surprise. And then he also had an accelerant, which gave him, chaos and confusion. Mm-hmm. And then he had his shingling hatchet, which was a wicked weapon. Even though he was only about 38 years old and a diminutive man, he attacked them all. And only two survived, Herbert Fritz and William Weston. And Weston, they both had injuries. But what's one thing I want to say, if I can continue with this for a second, is that small town Wisconsin really showed itself to be proud in the days after that that horrible crime. People call it a tragedy, but it really was a terrible crime. And you think that the stereotype of small town Wisconsin was that there was just going to be a lynch mob because mm-hmm. this man was black. He was an African-American from Chicago. And, of course, the headlines all made it out this way. He was the black beast, and he was a Negro slayer, and even the death certificates say killed by a Negro as a cause of death, as though it was like asphyxiation, a specific cause. But he got due process. He was given a court-appointed lawyer. He appeared in court twice, the second time on a stretcher. And that is because
good medical help too.
Well, he needed it because the last part of his preparations was that he had a bottle of hydrochloric acid in his pocket, and when he was found out, he swallowed it, and so it basically destroyed his esophagus, and he died 47 days later of starvation. But in the meantime, he got the medical. It was maybe almost celebrity treatment, but he got proper medical care as good as he could get in the jail. He got legal representation. And I think that small town Wisconsin really showed itself to be worthy of the Wisconsin tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. Karen and Dor Cody, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. My name is Karen Kopischke. I'm a costume designer, and I designed a play about Frank Lloyd Wright a few years ago at the Milwaukee Repertory Theater. When I was researching the play, I was only able to find one photograph of Mamah Cheney. And I always wondered, were there any other photographs of her? Are there any others? Were they destroyed in the fire, or did her first husband destroy them? Are there any photographs that exist of her other than the one that was in the newspaper?
Very good question, and I have an exciting answer for you. In Wright's last letter to Ellen Kay, he says, I'm enclosing a portrait of Mamah that she had made for me as a surprise for my birthday, and his birthday was on June 8th. So this was June 8th, 1914. And I recently have been able to find that portrait in Sweden
It
sent to me, and it's a full-length portrait. And I'm going to have it published at the earliest opportunity, and I'll certainly add it to the book if there's a second edition, which I hope. But I'll get it out there. It's a very lovely picture of her seated on a couch, and so it shows much more of her than any of the other photos. But you're right. One of the holy grail for me, I'm still looking for any pictures of Frank and Mamah together. In Italy, in Japan, in New York, in Wisconsin. I think that it's possible Taylor Woolley took some but did not include them in his public collections, or else made a deal with Frank that he would never point a camera in their direction, that they were so sensitive to publicity and maybe, things going viral as they would today. But there are at least one picture, and I'll try to find more, but I will try to get this published as soon as possible.
Oh, that would be wonderful. She was so far ahead of her time, and I was just dying to see what type of clothing she'd wear at that period. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Karen, for calling. And probably. Do you have a website, by the way?
I don't have a website, but if she wants to send me a note to maybe at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
Sure.
I will try to get a copy. I'll try to share the scan with her.
Oh, excellent. All right, Karen. There you go. Thank you very much for that call. And John in Dubuque, Iowa, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. How are you today?
Great. Thanks.
I just have a question. My wife's grandfather was John Flatt, and he was a noted architect in Madison.
Yes.
And he was supposedly an apprentice with Frank Lloyd Wright for some time. And they left on bad terms because Frank Lloyd Wright, I read in the Madison Journal, I believe, that would shake his cane at him every time he seen him on the street. I wonder if you knew anything about that.
Well, I certainly know the name of Flatt because it's still a very big and important architectural and construction company here in Madison and does a lot of very fine work. But I'm not familiar with that particular story. It doesn't surprise me because Wright left on bad – there were a number of apprentices who left on bad terms and others who stayed on who should have left.
There
okay,
you go.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Mitchell in New Berlin. Hi, Mitchell.
Good morning or good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm quite interested in what's happening to Taliesin down there in Spring Green. We were there 4 or 5 years ago and absolutely fascinated. But I've recall reading something in the Journal Sentinel about the poor financial and physical condition of Taliesin. And when we revisited, beautiful grounds, but the buildings were in sad shape. Has there been any funds or grants or anything to bring that back into working condition? Or
well, it's an ongoing problem, and it's an ongoing effort. I mean, the Taliesin preservation process is moving right along. They've been able to stabilize the building, keep it from rolling down the hill.
Mm-hmm.
A great deal more is needed. A great deal more money is needed. Unfortunately, I think the National Treasures Fund has dried up or is being canceled as a part of the budget cuts. It's hard to find preservation money. I'm hoping, actually, that my book sales will help Taliesin preservation. But you're right. He did not use the top flight materials and all the time, especially as he put on additions to the building. He didn't have money. He just had ideas. Unlike some of his better buildings that he did for rich people, Taliesin is in trouble and because he could not afford the good materials.
Mm-hmm.
And but you're right. Actually, one of the nice things about Taliesin is the beautiful condition of the gardens and the landscape.
Yes.
And luckily, if you can imagine development across the street from there, there's no development. There are no wires. Marshall Erdman, who was a builder in Madison, actually bought 4,000 acres of the view, the vista, to preserve it for Taliesin to keep. So you can still do time travel and coming to Taliesin and go through that beautiful valley and make it, it almost feels like it was 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. We'll be down there probably in another 3 weeks.
It's a great tour.
Yes, it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for calling. How much of the first Taliesin remains in the current building?
There are several buildings, several pieces of the first Taliesin that are still there. Some parts of it were farm buildings. The studio, the originals. You know, when the fire took place, it did not destroy the entire place. It destroyed the residential wing. And Wright rebuilt that. But there are still elements of it. And interestingly, Wright even put some of the burned colored rocks from the fire into the mortar of the newer buildings, just as a memento of it.
And as you said, reported, I believe he in this last 30 seconds here actually didn't dig the graves, but he covered the graves.
Of Mama.
Of Mama.
Her children were sent back to back to Chicago, but yes, he buried her himself. He filled her grave himself, and there was no service. But it was a lonely thing. And he cut down her garden and filled her coffin with the flowers. And I think that was suggestion about how this was really her house and her garden, and he buried it with her.
Ron, you have a wonderful book here. Thank you so much for being with us and talking with us about it. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, and thank your listeners. This has been a great talk.
Great, lots of fun. And the title of the book is Building Taliesin, Frank Lloyd Wright's Home of Love and Loss, written by Ron McCrae, and it's published by Wisconsin Historical Society Press. We have a link to that on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And I hope you really hope you have a chance to look at it and to read it. It's quite a remarkable book. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.